You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ina Garten has written 8 cookbooks, including her latest, Foolproof, Recipes You Can Trust. She's the Emmy Award-winning host of a long-running TV series on the Food Network. And although she is cooking royalty, known by all of her adoring fans as the Barefoot Contessa, she says she always keeps in mind the home cook who craves simplicity and ease. Her latest cookbook is published by Clarkson Potter, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Always wonderful to see you, too.
Your title promises foolproof recipes. Since you were once a nuclear energy budget analyst for the Office of Management and Budget at the White House.
You can understand the segue, can't you?
I was wondering whether you would advise that I trust but verify.
It's actually more related than you would think. I think of them both as science. And I think my interest in science brought me to both of those places. But I have to tell you, I'd much rather make sticky toffee date cake than nuclear fuel.
Well, you say that cooking is more like driving a car than constructing something.
It is, because one of the things about cooking is every time you come to the same recipe that you made before, the potatoes are a little bigger, the oven temperature is a little different, the herbs taste different, maybe you don't have the same salt you used last time. So you always have to be aware of what you're doing along the way. And I think a lot of people just sort of construct something. They say, I follow the recipe exactly, or I just throw things in without actually tasting it and not knowing what they have.
Well, I've even noticed that in making bread. That if you follow
completely
the recipe exactly, one time the bread comes out exactly as you wanted it, next time it didn't, and I assume that has to do
different.
With the humidity and maybe the yeast was a little less powerful or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly, exactly.
So what are the most important tips for foolproof cooking? It can't be just follow the recipe.
I think the first tip is follow the recipe. You'd be surprised how many people say, I made your chocolate cake and it didn't come out right. What's wrong with the recipe? And I followed it exactly. And when you find out that they actually didn't have any chocolate, they used sardines instead. And they wonder why the recipe didn't work. So the first thing is follow the recipe. I actually always recommend two things when you're making something like this. One is that you never test it on a party. You know, it's hard enough to make it for 2 people or 4 people the first time, but to test it on 8 people, I find that really stressful.
On the other hand, so many recipes say makes 8 portions, and then you're doing it for 2, and if you cut it into quarters,
sometimes that changes
it too.
It doesn't
work.
Exactly. But I think if you're doing a party, there's so many other things to worry about, setting the table, getting the house ready, cocktails, all the things that are involved with a party. To also test a recipe in the middle of that is really asking for trouble.
So who do you test it on? Your friends? You invite people over saying, I have this new thing I think I'm putting in my book?
Exactly. That's what I do. I say, okay, this is a test. And I test it on my husband or I test it on my friends. And sometimes they're invited over for dip dinners where I'm testing 4 different dips, and that's what dinner is.
But
they don't expect it was a dinner party.
Still, they probably trust you because they know that even if you mess up once in a while, it's still going to turn out pretty good.
Well, you know, it's not also just what I think. I'm actually not an easy cook. It's not something that comes naturally. I mean, I never worked in a restaurant, and especially a food store. So what I'm more interested in is what people want to eat at home. It's not necessary. It's the first step is it has to taste great, but there are so many more steps after that. And that is, do you want to eat this? Do you turn the page in the book and say, oh, my God, sticky toffee date cake. I love that, and I want to make it. That's really important to me. So I'll put out 4 desserts and say, which one do you like? It's not that I'm not sure whether you're going to actually like the caramel, salted caramel brownies. I'm pretty sure you're going to like them if I put them out. But I want to know whether you'd rather have that or sticky toffee date cake or raspberry crumble bars.
And you do, I've read, test some recipes up to 25 times.
I've been known to do that. I'm not sure most people. You could. You would know the difference between 24 and 25 because you're a great cook, but I'm not sure most people would know the difference, but I do. And I've got a flavor and a texture in my head when I start, and until I hit that ping, when I know I've hit it, then I keep going.
Well, most really good cooks cook by instinct to some degree. I'm not talking about baking. I'm talking about cooking. Mm-hmm. And I know when I've spoken to people who've done cookbooks, they've had assistants who then said, stop. And then they measured the amount of flour that was being put in or the amount of salt or whatever, because the cook rarely did that. Are you somebody who measures from the start?
We'll go back to the nuclear energy. I measure everything. I measure everything carefully. And in fact, even if I've made something 10 times, even after it's in a book, I still measure it because I've gotten the balance of flavors and textures and everything exactly the way I want it. I don't want to take any chances with it. I want it to be exactly what I'm looking for.
And then do you have other people try it out before you put it in a book?
Well, actually, what my system is, and I've sort of evolved this, is that I work on a recipe until it's exactly what I want it to be, and then I take a printed piece of paper, and I hand it to my assistant, and I watch her make it. And you wouldn't imagine the wacky things that she does from a printed page. And that's how I know somebody at home is going to see those words and make that same mistake.
Well, to some degree, it's also about organizing, isn't it? I'll find myself in the middle of a recipe and something's on the stove for 2.5 minutes, and then it says, chop up an onion.
Well, meanwhile, chop an onion. Well, that's hopefully I'm going to catch that first. But what I realize is I can chop an onion in 2.5 minutes. My assistant can't. So
I can't.
Meanwhile, I don't know if I can. I've never timed myself. But meanwhile, the oil that you've heated up is now too hot. So it's very interesting for me to watch somebody who's a good, a nice home cook, but make a recipe.
My guest is Ina Garten, who is also known as the Barefoot Contestant. We'll get to that later. Her latest book is called Foolproof, Recipes You Can Trust. You include tips for foolproof Thanksgiving, and since that's coming up, I thought maybe we'd talk about that for a moment. Is it true that you prefer to cook the entire meal by yourself?
I've done the opposite, which is ask everybody to help, and I ended up cooking the meal by myself anyway. So,
but you don't ask your husband to mince the onions or chop up a little garlic once?
No. He's really good at a lot of things, but cutting up onions isn't his forte.
He doesn't mash potatoes?
No, his job is to tell me how delicious the Thanksgiving dinner is, and he's very good at that.
Is this a matter of your being a control freak?
No, he's just not a cook. Oh,
but others?
He makes really good coffee.
Can you ever assign other people?
What I did one year is I thought it would be really fun for us to all to make desserts together. Everybody would bring their favorite pie recipe, and we would all make pies together. And what I found is everybody was watching the football game, and I was making 4 different pies. So I never did that again.
Thanksgiving dinner is usually an exercise in overkill, 4 different pies.
Exactly.
More vegetables than you could ever eat, and turkey on top of it all. So how many dishes do you make?
I usually make the turkey, and I never stuff it. I always make the stuffing on the outside. There's a mushroom leek bread pudding, which is like stuffing, so it's crisp on the top, and it's moist inside, and the turkey cooks in less time, which makes it moister, which is wonderful. And all of the stuff about frying turkeys and brining turkeys and all those things, I just find the simplest turkey is the best. And at the end of the day, the turkey's not the star in the meal anyway. It's the side dishes.
But you kind of brine it. You put salt on it, and then you put it in your refrigerator for a few days.
I do. But, it's not a complicated thing. It's a fairly simple process. But I always make, in addition to the mushroom leek bread pudding, I'll make spinach gratin, which is a classic Barefoot recipe, just so fabulous, and maybe mashed sweet potatoes. And that's it. I mean, it's a fairly simple meal, and it's everybody's favorite dinner.
And no Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah, I have to make Brussels sprouts.
Now, you've called your turkey recipe accidental turkey.
Well, a friend actually had an accidental turkey, which turned out to be a great surprise. And that's part of the scientific process, too, is when you have an accident in the laboratory, you always watch it and see what happens. She put the turkey in thinking for a high temperature to sort of sear the outside, and then very quickly you turn down the temperature, and of course in the chaos she completely forgot, and it turned out to be an absolutely delicious turkey. And she's right, it is.
So you never turned it down?
I turned it down, but after quite a while, not immediately. And it was just delicious. It's a delicious turkey.
Now, you said you don't believe in brining, although brining does work.
Well, the other thing you can do is get a kosher turkey, which has already been brined.
It's been salted.
It's already been salted, which is basically, people think brining, you have to put it into a huge pot of water and salt and herbs and all this stuff. All you have to do is salt the outside, which is good for any kind of chicken, for fish, anything.
Now, we've been hearing for a while that you should cook the stuffing outside of the turkey, although the name stuffing does suggest you put it in. And the old theory,
stuffing isn't stuffing yourself.
Yeah, but you also, there's also a health risk, isn't there, when you're doing leftovers, if you leave the stuffing into the turkey carcass?
Well, it just takes longer for the whole thing to cool. And I think certainly everybody says you should have cold turkey and cold stuffing before you put them together. And when it retains the heat more. I think usually when you cook a turkey that's been stuffed, you take the stuffing out and serve it separately. But I always find it kind of mushy. It doesn't have any texture for me. And then you have to cook it long enough so the stuffing is cooked to a certain temperature. So now the turkey is dry. So I think it's so much better to do them separately.
You say that you're turned off by turducken. Now, NPR for years has been doing a thing where all these chefs come in to do turducken. It was a style 100 years ago, 200 years ago, but I don't get it either.
I'm so glad you don't, because I think what I love is the true flavor of something. And when you have a turkey with a duck with a chicken inside, I don't know what you're eating. It's too confusing for my brain.
You also have a recipe for a better pumpkin pie. What makes it better?
The bourbon, I think. I think it's rum in it. It makes everything better.
And then pie crust. That's where so many people have problems. Hard to do a perfect pie crust.
Pie crust, the recipes don't differ that much. But what differs is it's really important to have small pieces of butter in the dough itself. And then when the heat of the oven hits the butter, it causes the water to evaporate and it makes a flaky pie crust. I've actually learned something recently that I'm going to try with a pie crust, is if you add a little bit of vinegar to it, it ends up being very flaky. Have you ever done that?
No.
I had never come across that. And I was at Sinsky Vineyards in California, and Maria Sinsky, who's an incredible chef, taught me that, and I'm going to try it with the regular pie crust.
But you're saying instead of really mixing the butter in with the flour, leave some lumps.
When you have the roll, when you're rolling it out, you should see little bits of butter in it. I actually do it in a food processor. So I take really flour and salt and then very, very cold butter and ice water and work it really quickly and always let it rest for an hour in the refrigerator before you roll it out.
Do you try to stick to the traditional foods for every holiday?
I do.
Christmas dinner, New Year's Eve?
I always like traditional things. I just like to make them a little better than you expect. New Year's Eve, I always make my favorite thing to make is it's in my first book, The Barefoot Contessa Cookbook. It's cappellini with caviar. It's cappellini with butter and lemon zest with a nice little dollop of caviar on top. Everybody's very happy.
Now, before we go to a break, you inherited the Barefoot Contessa name, didn't you?
I did, in fact. I did.
It has nothing to do with your background in nuclear physics.
No. I actually bought the store after it had been going for about a year or two, and it was called the Barefoot Contessa because the woman who owned it was Italian, and when she was young, they used to call her the Barefoot Contessa. And in the beginning, I thought it's probably not a great name for a food store because it's not that related. But as I got into it, I realized it was great because it's about being elegant and earthy, and that's really what my style is.
Well, it was the name of a book.
A movie.
And then a movie. Joseph
exactly.
Mankiewicz starred Ava Gardner.
It was unbelievable in it.
Oh, because I heard that for years you refused to watch it, or you didn't?
No, I didn't refuse to watch it. I had never watched it. I watched it a few years ago.
It's
quite a dark
Netflix.
Movie. It's quite a dark movie, but I mean, it's incredible. It's a wonderful
We cannot
movie.
Imagine Ava Gardner being a good cook. She had
I think
other
she was
attributes.
Good at other things.
But the Barefoot Contessa really, that also branded you, and that's not a bad thing.
No, it's wonderful.
Now, when you came along, were you following in the footsteps of other people who had made the same move? People like Julia Child, who had worked for the OSS and then suddenly taught us how to cook. Marcella Hazan, who also had a career before she wound up writing cookbooks.
I'm not sure that I made that switch the same way, but I did when my husband and I were first married, even before we were in the government, and he was in the State Department and the White House as well.
He's an economist?
He was the dean of the business school at Yale, an economist. Yeah, exactly. Is that when we went on a four-month camping trip before we moved to Washington, and we were in France and England, and we traveled around, and I cooked every meal in our little tent with a camping gas stove. And seeing the markets in France were so inspiring. When I came back, the first thing I did was buy Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking and made every dinner party in Washington from that.
Oh, so I thought
she was my education.
I thought you were going to put a tent in the backyard and start cooking there as well.
No, I gave away the tent after that trip.
Ina Garten's latest book is Foolproof Recipes You Can Trust. We'll be back with the Barefoot Contessa after we take a little break. Stay with us. I'm back with Ina Garten, the best-selling author of cookbooks, among other things, and also the very popular television hostess as the Barefoot Contessa. Her latest book is called Foolproof Recipes You Can Trust. It's published by Clarkson Potter. It's got lots of gorgeous pictures in it. Was that important?
Thank you.
You know,
very important.
Because publishers don't love to stick a lot of colored photos in. That raises the costs of a book.
It does. It does.
But it's the only way we can,
and
to me it's the only way that I can really know what the thing should look like.
And I always, from the first book, I always wanted you to open the book. And I think more people are visual than they are word-oriented. Publishers tend to be more word-oriented than visual, but I'm more visual. So I wanted you to open the book and just go, that looks delicious, and then look at the recipe and say, wait a minute, I can actually make that, and I can buy all the ingredients in a grocery store. That's always been my system, and I don't think that's changed in 8 books.
So it doesn't matter whether you buy it at a green market or somewhere else. If you can get it at a grocery store, that's perfectly fine?
I think, obviously, the quality of the ingredients, if you're doing simple recipes, is important. So, I'll write good olive oil just to make sure somebody doesn't buy just anything that's there, because it'll change what you're making.
Or chocolate,
and there are any ingredient. But I think everybody just chooses the best ingredient that they can, feel comfortable buying.
Well, one of the surprising dishes in the book is an hors d'oeuvre of caramelized bacon.
Isn't that crazy?
Now, does this mean really good bacon, or can I use white rose it's on sale?
I think the better bacon it is, the better it's going to taste. Yeah. But, at the end of the day, I think the real key is that if you cook, you're going to eat better than if you don't. It's that simple. You're going to have better ingredients, better nutrition, and when you cook, everybody shows up, so you'll have a better community as well.
And they often have said that the best cook for you is you, because you know what you like.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how did you come up with the idea of caramelized bacon?
Actually, a friend told me that her mother used to make it, and I thought, wow, what a great idea that is.
And you use...
We did it so many times just to make sure it was really good.
Well, it seems to me...
it's like margaritas. Anything, you have to test them a lot.
Anything with bacon, you seem
exactly.
pretty good.
Bacon and sugar.
You also use interesting ingredients like creme de cassis in a chocolate cake.
It's very interesting. I'm always looking for that one thing that's going to take whatever I'm making and really sort of turn up the volume. And cassis and raspberries in a chocolate cake are really fantastic. It's cassis is a very interesting ingredient. I think it's black currant, and it's you sometimes don't really know it's there, but it just has an intense hit of flavor.
There are a number of ingredients that have that kind of impact.
And what are they for you?
Well,
I know the ones I always go to.
Well, now my mind is blanking, but but the idea that there's this thing there that it gives you a little undertone.
Exactly.
And,
exactly. It doesn't hit you in the head. It's a layered flavor. For me, it's always Parmesan cheese, really good Parmesan cheese. There's something about the salt in it and the flavor and the spiciness of it. Sometimes it's an acid like vinegar, or lemon juice is very often the thing for me, where you've got like a lentil soup that needs a little something, and it's a drizzle of red wine vinegar does it.
And lemon juice often does really well in something that's meant to be sweet.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Which seems counterintuitive.
It does, yeah.
You put ginger in your carrot cake.
I do. I love ginger and carrot together. And crystallized ginger in the frosting, in the mascarpone frosting.
You say that German chocolate cake isn't actually a German
thing. It's not a German thing. Didn't you always think it was a German thing?
Of course.
It turns out it's German chocolate, which is that unsweetened chocolate. It's a brand.
Well, one of the things that you have emphasized over the years is the importance of menu planning. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem? Some people just get too ambitious, do too many things that are going to just take up too much time.
I think everybody does it. I think it's, you know, when I sit down, I have guests coming and I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to make? And I just start writing down everything I feel like making. And it's impossible. You've got, you know, a few burners on the top of the stove. You've got one or two ovens and you've got a certain amount of time. And so then what I do is long before I've gone shopping, I start crossing things off. Do I really need four vegetables? No, I really don't. Will people have more fun if I've made some fancy dessert? Or will they really enjoy just something very simple or maybe something from a great bakery?
But there's also the problem of timing it perfectly so that, you know, you say, well, the guests will start showing up at 7, so when should we put it on the table? And then, yeah. Of course, somebody always shows up really late.
What I think people are really shocked, because I've been in the food business for, 35 years, that when they come into the kitchen, there is a schedule on my counter that's everything that I need to do, including turn the oven to 325 degrees. It's so specific, because then at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm going, there must be something I should be doing, but I can't remember what it is.
Do you chop up everything in advance the way you do on television so that you could just take a little monkey dish and dump it into the pan and say, okay, here's the ginger. We'll let it cook for a little bit.
Well, it depends on the recipe, but a lot of times I do, because then, I mean, it's in French, it's called the mise en place. If you have all your ingredients in front of you, you're so much less likely to forget to put one of them in. So I think it's a really good idea.
Now, you have the advantage of having large space to cook in. In fact, you do your TV shows in your own home, don't you?
I do. Well, actually, I have a regular, you know, sort of home kitchen in my house, and then next door I have a barn that has a much bigger kitchen. But I don't actually believe in huge kitchens, because then you can make a huge mess that takes forever to clean up. I like kitchens that have sort of tight working spaces. They can be in a big room, but the actual working space isn't that big.
Because you can just turn around.
Yeah.
But you have two Sub-Zero refrigerators and an 8-burner stove.
Well, in the barn, what I did was I took my home kitchen and I doubled it so that I have a kitchen with a refrigerator, dishwasher, and the stove and the sink in the middle. And my assistant next to me has the same thing. So she can be retesting a recipe while I'm making a new one.
You also suggest that we think about where we're going to be doing things. So we can do one thing in the oven, another thing on the stovetop. Not have everything cooking on the stovetop or three different things in the oven.
Exactly, at different temperatures. You get to that moment when you go, oh, my goodness, I need three ovens, and they have to be at three different temperatures. What am I going to do?
Why didn't you warn me about this last weekend?
Oh. And the other thing, there are two things I always look for in a menu. One is, does everything have to be served hot? Or are some things just fine at room temperature and some things hot? So maybe the filet of beef is room temperature, but the sauce is hot. So you don't have to have everything out at exactly the same moment. And also, can I make one thing on the top of the stove, one thing in the oven, and one thing that was prepared in advance?
Is there an ideal number of guests?
For me, it's 6. I like 6-8 tops and a round table, a 48-inch round table. If it's 8, maybe a 54-inch round table. But I think that makes the best party. And I actually feel so strongly about that even if we're going to a restaurant together, I always go in advance and make sure we have the right table, because it can make or break a party. Don't you agree?
Well, I haven't thought much about the table. I'm just happy when they give me a table. But I think I go to the point about going to a restaurant for me is I'm going there for things that I don't cook at home.
Mm-hmm.
The things that either are too hard to prepare or too exotic, I want to try things that
You like to try? Oh, that's interesting.
On the other hand, at home, I want to cook things that I feel comfortable mm-hmm. making and I know that my guests will like.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
You, what are some of the common questions you get asked? Do people ask you about frozen food and freezing ingredients?
I mean, I'm a big believer in frozen things. I mean, some things freeze well and some don't. Frozen vegetables, I use frozen pearl onions a lot because they're perfectly delicious and they don't get damaged in the freezing process. Peppers don't freeze so well, so I wouldn't do that.
Peas do.
Peas freeze beautifully. Artichokes freeze beautifully. There are some vegetables that are perfectly good, and I use them a lot because, I mean, nobody needs to peel a small whole onion. They're impossible.
Well, we're talking about dinners for large groups, but I'm sure that most of the cooking you do is for you and your husband.
Both. I mean, mostly I cook for either just Jeffrey and me, or I cook for, you know, I invite maybe two couples over and
for on six a regular people. Basis?
Yeah, pretty regularly.
Oh. Well, I have to move nearer your house.
Both my vocation and my avocation.
And I'm sure you're testing things out on people.
Well, I always like to see what they choose first, what that kind of thing, yeah.
Melissa Clark wrote an article recently in the New York Times about what to do when the dish turns out to be a disaster. The first thing she said is
we've all had that.
She says you rename it.
That's really great.
Pull it with charred onion. Several of the ingredients in this book were inspired by things you had in restaurants. Now, when let's say you mentioned the Bernardin and the 1770 house in East Hampton, also some places in Paris and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. When you have a really wonderful dish, do you immediately start trying to figure out how it was constructed?
I mean, I'm always sort of taking in information wherever I am. And very often restaurants have a different kind of cuisine, as you say, that, you know, more, I mean, cassoulet and things like that. I just never need to make a cassoulet at home. And they have bain-maries and they have sous chefs and they have demi-glace and sheets of gelatin and things you just don't want to know about and can't find anywhere. But every once in a while I have something that really inspires me and I just think, well, that would be great to take home and translate into a way that somebody at home could make it.
And when you see something in a shop or in a mm-hmm. farmer's market that you've never seen before, are you immediately curious about what you can do with it?
Yeah. I mean, I like to find a new ingredient. I remember when I discovered sriracha, I thought, this is great. It's heat, but it's got flavor as well. So then you start thinking about, or like I became enamored maybe two books ago with truffle butter, which is fantastic. It's butter with literally shaved truffles in it. It's not
if
any,
you can afford them.
Well, and a pot of truffle butter costs like $8 or $10.
Oh, really?
And it's real white truffles. And it just has unbelievable flavor. So it transforms any dish. So it's something I now keep in the freezer. So I love to find a new ingredient.
David Boulay says that the fall is his favorite time of year because of the kinds of ingredients available.
Me
you
too?
Yeah.
Well, because I live in the East Hampton, all the apple orchards have the most incredible varieties of apples and pears. And I love butternut squash. I love that. And Thanksgiving's definitely my favorite meal of the year.
But you also live part of the time in Paris, don't you?
Well, not really. I mean, I live in East Hampton, but we're really fortunate to be able to go to Paris a lot.
Your recipes do call sometimes for butter, cream, half and half. Do you worry about using too much of that? Or do you think about cholesterol? A recipe with a dozen eggs in it?
The recipe for a dozen eggs isn't for one. I just, you know, I think that good food is really important, and I think substituting fake food for good food is a bad idea. And I think most people know how to balance something, a treat, with something that's fresh. And I think that's important for each person to do for themselves. So you have vegetables and you have, you know, a really good meal, and then you have a treat for dessert.
The reason I ask is I read that your mother was a dietitian.
She was.
Well, did that mean good food or
no, obsessive,
or not good?
Compulsive. No, it wasn't about good food.
and she wouldn't let you cook?
Wouldn't let me cook. My job was to study. She liked it. She said, my job is to cook. It should have been the other way around.
So how did you teach yourself to cook?
By really studying Julia Childs. And I think I was always interested in it, and maybe because my mother wouldn't let me, that even had more appeal. But I really just worked my way through mastering the art of French cooking.
And then Italian food as well? You mentioned Marcello Hazan.
Not so much Marcello Hazan. More traditional French cooking.
So if somebody doesn't want to go to one of the fancy cooking schools, which... Mm-hmm. And doesn't want to become a professional chef, but wants to be a good home chef.
Well, I have no training. I mean, I just...
So what would you recommend? Just find some cookbooks that you really trust. Watch some... Did they have to watch those shows on the cooking channel?
That's always a good idea.
Especially if it's yours, right?
Especially. Actually, it's funny. I think one of the things that I love most about... I mean, it was completely unexpected. But when people stop me in the street, the thing I hear most, which pleases me the most, is, you taught me how to cook. And I just think the more people that cook, the happier we all are, but both the guests and the cooks. But you really can... I mean, I completely taught myself how to cook with Julia, because she's really a teacher. It's not just about picking up a cookbook. It's about working with somebody who really shows you why it works to make hollandaise the right way. You can always make it with a blender, but if you make it the traditional way, you really understand how the thing comes together. And I think once you have that understanding, then you can go off on your own.
Well, it was very important for her, for us to do the authentic thing.
Exactly.
And I once had asked her and Jacques Pepin, which one of you is... more likely to stick to the old traditional recipe, and they both agreed that it was Julia.
It had to be Julia. That wouldn't
Jacques
be surprising.
Was ready to go off and try anything new.
And how wonderful that you have a conversation with the two of them. That must have been amazing.
So you said that you're a business person who cooks.
That is how I think of myself.
Really?
Well, I'm not somebody who worked on a line in a restaurant. I'm not somebody who has that kind of experience. But in a funny way, that's worked for me, because my experience is in especially food store. I spent 20 years running Barefoot Contessa, and I really know what people eat at home, and I also know how to make something very simply, because I'm not a trained professional chef.
Did customers come in and say, "What can I do with this?"
What can I do with what?
With something they were thinking of buying. I know when I lived in Chinatown, people would go up to the people who were selling fish or produce
and say, what can I do with this?
Yeah, what can I do with this? They always had some kind of suggestion.
I think most people came into the store because they wanted something done for them, not to do with it.
You were selling prepared foods.
That's
as well.
Right. It's mostly prepared foods. We made everything. We made the baked goods. We make the dinner salads, all of that. Yeah.
Is it true that you rejected several proposals by the Food Network before you agreed to do the show?
Well, they very kindly came after me, and I thought, I could never in a million years think about doing this. I just thought I'd be terrible at it. So for years, I said, no, thank you very much. I really appreciate your offer. And I think all those times they thought I was negotiating, but I wasn't. I really didn't think I could do it. So they finally got me to do a test of 13 shows, and I thought, well, that'll be it, and we'll be done with that. And happily, it was 10 years ago, so I'm incredibly grateful to them for persevering.
And I'm sure that it somehow works with the development of cookbooks. You've developed a recipe for a cookbook, and then you show it on television, or do you wait until it's your two books passed?
No, I usually do a book, and then when that book is published, then I do those recipes on TV. I just the TV is really important, because people get information different ways. I mean, some people get information by reading about it, but some people find a recipe hard to follow. And so if you can't get the information, if you can't make the raspberry crumble bars based on the recipe in the book, then you can see me on TV doing it. So if you have any questions, you'll see how it's done.
And now you're suddenly starting to get into blogging? What
Isn't
does that mean
shocking?
For you?
Well, you know, I've run in the other direction, like most of the things that I've ended up doing for a really long time, and finally I thought, you know, the only way to know what this is to just jump in the pond. And so about 6 months ago, I started blogging, and it turned out to be so interesting. I'm completely stunned how interesting it is.
Have you been tempted to do what a lot of people...
No, I don't know. Whatever it is, I haven't been tempted. What?
Come out with a Barefoot Contessa line of vinegars and mustards and...
Well, every once in a while, the idea comes across my screen.
You used to be in government. Do you still follow politics?
As little as possible.
Really? You don't think about nuclear proliferation anymore?
I don't worry about it as much as I used to.
Just about exploding cakes and things like that.
I worry about chocolate instead.
Now, you were born in Brooklyn, weren't you?
I was. Yes.
So when did you leave?
When I was five.
Uh-huh.
My father was a physician, and he moved his practice to Connecticut. So I really grew up in Connecticut, but I did live in Brooklyn, and it was before it was totally cool to live in Brooklyn.
And now it's become the center of artisanal food.
It is. It's wonderful. I've actually done a few shows there, and I love going to Brooklyn and to Franny's, to the that wonderful restaurant makes incredible wood-burning oven pizza.
Have you noticed that people's tastes have changed since you started working in the business?
I think there have been trends over the 35 years I've been in business. I can't say that my cooking has changed at all. The only thing I can say is as I go back to recipes that I wrote 10 years ago, I think they could use a little more flavor. And I don't know whether the ingredients have changed or my taste has changed. But I think we're now demanding much more flavor from things than we did 20 years ago.
And how do you get more flavor out of something other than good ingredients? Because there probably were good ingredients 30 years ago.
There were, but I think the ingredients probably are, I don't know how they've changed. But I think it's really, the chef once said to me, and I think it's really true, that the biggest mistake that home cooks make are the two ingredients that everybody has is salt and pepper.
Well, now the fad seems to be sea salts, and if you got a lot of money, you can buy about 10 different kinds of sea
salt. Black and red and pink and everything else. But at the end of the day, it's all salt.
has that grabbed you?
Or? I like gradations of salt because I like to use kosher salt when I'm cooking, but I like to use fleur de sel to finish something because it has that sort of soft, briny flavor without being like the hit of salt. So I do. Those are the two that I use a lot. And every once in a while, like mulled and flaked sea salt is great. If I'm doing a crust, like a pot pie crust, it's nice to brush it with egg yolk and sprinkle it with mulled and sea salt and pepper.
Now, you've called this book Foolproof Recipes You Can Trust. Mm-hmm. You are putting yourself on the line, aren't you?
I am. But I do with all my books. I just think that is really what my trademark has been about, is that all the recipes are foolproof. That if you make them according to the recipe, you know they'll turn out exactly the way the photograph is and that they'll be delicious.
Foolproof Recipes You Can Trust. From Ina Garten, the Barefoot Contessa. The book is published by Clarkson Potter. Got lots of pictures.
Lots
Some people
of pictures
say too
are
many,
important.
But I think just enough.
Has anyone said too many?
Thank you so much for being on our show.
That's really
again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Leonard.